Good evening. My name is Sherry Zhong, and I'm a student project manager at the Clock Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clock Forum, the Department of Anthropology, and the first year seminars, I would like to welcome you to this evening's program, Virtual Popular Culture. A virtual world is a computer-based simulated environment inhabited by avatars. All virtual worlds allow users to communicate with each other through various forms such as text, graphical icons, visual gesture, and sound. Virtual worlds can be social virtual worlds, casual gaming virtual worlds, role-playing virtual worlds, and virtual worlds for content creation. The number of personal and enterprise virtual worlds users has grown rapidly. In 2008, there were over 300 million such users worldwide. We are fortunate to have with us tonight an expert on virtual popular culture, Tom Bersdorf, professor in the Department of Anthropology at the University of California, Irvine, and editor-in-chief of American Anthropologist, the flagship journal of the American Anthropological Association. His research project has focused on questions of virtual worlds, sexuality, globalization, nationalism, language, and HIV/AIDS. He's also a core faculty member for the Cultural and Theory PhD program at Irvine, as well as a program faculty member for the Arts, Computation, and Engineering graduate program. He has worked as a consultant for the Intel Corporation and sits on advisory boards of two community-based HIV/AIDS organizations in Indonesia. At this time, I would like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and other electronic devices. Also, since this program is being taped and some of our audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait for a microphone to reach you before asking a question during the question and answer session at the end of the program. Thank you. And now please join me in welcoming Tom Bersdorf.
Thank you, Sherry. Thank you, Sherry, and everyone. Thank you all so much for inviting me. I'm very happy to be here. I've had a great day today. Is the mic working okay? Yes? We'll assume that it is. Okay, it was going to be unmuted. I've had a great time being here so far today, and I'm really thankful for this opportunity to come and talk to you all. That was a very generous and wonderful introduction. And so what I'm going to do today, a lot of you may not obviously know what virtual worlds are, but as we just heard in that great introduction, they're rapidly becoming a big part of human social life, and they raise a lot of interesting challenges to the way that we think about culture and the relationship between technology and culture. In fact, one could argue that they are the biggest sort of technological shift in human culture since the invention of the printing press. And so what I'm going to do is talk to you about Second Life, this virtual world where I have done research. My original research and continuing research is in Indonesia, as you heard in the introduction, but I also do research in Second Life. And because these worlds are so new, understanding history is really important. So I'm going to talk about the history of these virtual worlds. What are they? Why should we care about them? And how did I study them? Because the basic idea behind my research in Second Life has been to take the methods that I've used in Indonesia over the years and try them online to see how they would work. And it turned out that they worked really well. And then how does this link up to popular culture? Since that's a theme for this for the Clark Forum, I think there's two interesting things, that virtual worlds are sites of popular culture in themselves. All over the world, they're rapidly becoming sites of formation for popular culture, but they're also becoming part of popular culture. So they're entering into our popular culture in all kinds of ways that I think are really interesting. And an overall point that I'll mention from the beginning, that whenever new technologies come into being, there's often really utopian but also really negative interpretations of them, that they're going to make everything wonderful and save the world, or that they're going to ruin everything. And as I'll mention later, most people, when they hear what is a virtual world, what they're most used to is the Matrix movies, where a virtual world is used to enslave humanity, which is not the best press for virtual worlds. And an overall point I want to make is that, you know, like any technology, radio, TV, cars, you name it, virtual worlds are value neutral. They hold danger and potential, but they hold a lot of great potential, and I think that we don't want to judge them too quickly as something that's negative, because they do hold a lot of positive potential, and I think by understanding them better, we can try and make sure that as they develop, they do have that positive impact on us. Now, one sort of brief point, and I am an anthropologist, and if I had more time, I would do a whole anthropology thing, because I obviously love anthropology, but one reason why I think it's important to look at virtual worlds that links up to broad themes going all the way back to the basic sort of ideas of anthropology, studying a culture is that cultures often present themselves as if they're made up of distinct domains. And if you even look at departments at Dickinson College or at a university, you often get this idea that there's this bounded culture, and then there's things in it like gender or economics, politics, or so on, and that this is sort of a popular model of culture that we often have out in popular culture. It's like an internal theory that people often have about culture. But this is obviously wrong. This isn't how cultures work. And the research that I do in the talk I'm doing today is predicated upon the insight that, first of all, cultures don't have clear external domains. People migrate, ideas move from one place to the other all the time, and also that these domains inside of culture intersect and shape each other. And so, you know, a great example I always use in my intro to anthro class is I say, you know, in Western culture, how do you make a baby? What are the ways that you can make a baby? And it turns out there's two. You can birth it or adopt it. Those are the two common ways that we think you can create a child. And so how is it that you become a citizen in the United States? Well, there's two ways. You're born here, or you become naturalized by getting adopted. Well, isn't that funny that the two ways of becoming a citizen and the two ways of becoming born as a human are the same, and that the word for nation shares a root with natal and is about sort of kinship. And right there, you can see obviously how the way we think about family and the way we think about nation intersect. So that kind of general point is something that is common to my approach in Indonesia and the way that I look at Second Life. Now, I don't have time to do a whole involved explanation or demonstration of Second Life, but because a lot of people aren't familiar with these things, I do want to show you briefly just a couple quick things about Second Life and a couple interesting little pieces of film clips that people have made about virtual worlds, just to give you some very, very basic rough ideas about Second Life. So here is Second Life. Here is my avatar. There's my belt buckle. Standing, I'm using a mouse I'm not used to, so it's a little hard for me to see. But here I am standing inside of Second Life, you know, say wow to everyone. Wow, there everyone is looking at me. So this is my avatar inside of Second Life. And so what a virtual world is, unlike a website, is a sort of three-dimensional environment where you can interact with other people. And this building is a house that I built on land that I own, that I pay for using U.S. dollars. And by owning the land, I can build in real time inside of Second Life. So because I own this land, I can just point at the ground and say, create a box. And there you see that box appear. And I could, that's a little hard to do with a new mouse, let me see here. But I can, So I could take this box, I could move it around. So here you see me moving it around. There it is right next to me. I could change its shape, I could make it tall. I could rotate it. I could put a texture on it. So here you can see me rotating it. And I could do this with other people collaboratively in real time. And as I've created this object, other people anywhere in the world who are logged on will see this, because the object is not just inside of my computer. It's on a shared server, right, that a lot of people are sharing. Someone's trying to IM me, but don't worry about that. And I can even sit on this object, right? So here I am sitting on the object that I've created and move it around. And so everything that you see here in my house, I've built by doing that kind of work where you can build in real time inside of a virtual world. And I could move in a virtual world, of course, you don't have to eat or anything, and you can fly. And so I can fly up, and here you can see, you know, there's this landscape with, here's some of my neighbors, some of the nice things they've built, you know, beautiful waterscape. Many of these virtual worlds have very powerful.
I'm lucky I have my partner, and we have great, right, great land manager, and I have a great assistant.
Let me mute that. But just to show, like, if I were to go underwater, let me see if I can pull down underwater enough here. You see that, the reflection? You can even see the reflection of my avatar. That's a very complicated graphical thing to do. What you're hearing there in the sound,
okay,
is
great. Thank you.
In my office down here, I have a TV set where I can watch. There are Second Life TV programs run by the Second Life television network. So here's my TV. Let me see what was playing. That was something they're playing on the TV. But you can make anything, do anything that you want. So there's universities in Second Life, companies, you know, people build homes, there's shopping malls, art galleries, all kinds of things, and that people are interacting in real time. So these green dots, let me wait, move
back in. Here's my house, and here's me in this map of Second Life. And the green dot that you see is another person who's logged on somewhere in the world. And even when I was in Second Life, you saw how the, like when I'm flying around here, you would see sort of objects that aren't there come into being. That's called rezzing, because none of this information is on my computer. So when I go to a new area, let me like fly up here to my neighbor's house, over my neighbor's house, the computer has to download all of that data. This is what makes a virtual world able something to be shared, right? So here how it looks blank for a moment. Now as I sit here, see, look how the computer is downloading all that information. It's very complicated actually to be able to do that. So in the same way, this world map is sort of slowly coming into place. So here you can see me in the water next to my house. Here I am, whoops, sorry about that. Let me bring that back. Here's my house, here's me. And each of these green dots is someone who is in Second Life right now, logged in somewhere in the world. And as I step back, you get just a small feeling for how massive Second Life is. I mean, I could keep going and going and going, and the green dots aren't even uploading fast enough, because there's, you know, tens of thousands of people in Second Life at any one moment in time. And they could be logged in from anywhere in the world. And Second Life is a small virtual world, you know, compared to others. And so if I, and I can, you can teleport anywhere inside of Second Life that will allow you to do it. Let me see, just to show you an example or two of things that people do in terms of building. So, and so people build things that look very unlike anything else, or things that look similar to things in the physical world. So for instance, see if I can get this to teleport. Because I'm a different internet system, if I crash, don't worry, hopefully it won't crash. I'm just going to show you one or two places, then move on with the talk, because I just want to very quickly give you a very quick idea for some of the sort of possibilities that you get in Second Life. So here, this will take a bit to res, as they say, download. That this is a, oops, here, guy. Stop flying for a minute. But as I step back, you'll see what's coming into being. And this entire gigantic cathedral was built like out of boxes, just like I showed you from that demonstration. Someone owns this land, this island, and they've built this replica of a French cathedral that's actually very detailed, even to the interior design, the interior architecture, the roof. It's all been very faithfully recreated. And there's actually a lot of art galleries and cities even that use Second Life for that kind of purpose. Let me see if I can get the doors to open for me. Open door? Well, this door's open, so I can just walk out. Oh, wait, there's some people close by. Oh, and here's someone. So here's someone who's somewhere in the world. I have no idea where. I have no idea if this is a man or woman in the physical world. What's their race, gender, language? All I know is I can click on them and see what their profile is, how they've chosen to identify themselves. So here, but they say nothing about themselves but that I'm a flirt. And so, you know, and people often don't choose to review that much about them. But I could use voice or I could type chat to talk to this person. I'm not going to bother them right now. But you know, this is one of the hundreds of green dots that can be anywhere inside of Second Life. So if we have more time at the end, I could show you more about more of these things of Second Life. There's so many fascinating things. But because it takes time to load and stuff, to speed things up, I'm just going to show you an example or two of clips that people have made, sort of tour guides showing things about Second Life.
With every waking breath I breathe, I see what life has dealt to me. With every sadness I deny, I feel a chance inside me. That give me a taste of something new to touch, to hold, to pull me through. Send me a guiding light that shines across this darkened life of mine. Some soul in me, a gift of love to me, life to live for me.
There's so much cool artwork done in Second Life, I could show it forever, but I don't have time. This I'll just show. This is just a two-minute short film that someone made entirely inside of Second Life. Be clear on the sort of basic ideas around the way that Second Life works is that, and I won't show another clip that I wanted to show, but I just don't have time. I can show it later if there's time. But that a virtual world like Second Life, none of the stuff that you saw is actually created by the company that owns it. They just create the basic landscape. So it's actually a very interesting theory of labor because people are prosuming. They are producing and consuming. They are, so all of the content that you saw, not just the movie, but the church, my house, everything, none of that is created by the company. There are other virtual worlds, like World of Warcraft, that are more game-oriented, where the company hires staff to make stuff. This is much more of the kind of theory behind applications for the iPhone, where the company tries to tap crowd, what's called crowdsourcing, tapping the creativity of other people to create the content that other people will then consume. Which is a very interesting theory of production. So I don't have time to go into detail on this because I want to move on to the history, but Second Life, when I started, was very small, but it's actually fairly large now in that you've got about 1.5 million active users. You can have 60 to 80,000 people online. The amount of time that people spend talking on inside of Second Life is already about 12% of all of Skype, if you know what Skype is, so it's very big. Over $1 billion U.S. in virtual goods has been exchanged. So one reason they get people to want to create stuff inside of Second Life and some of these other virtual worlds is like the shirt that you saw my avatar wearing. So like here I am still standing here. This shirt I bought. Someone designed it. I bought it for about $1 U.S. And there's the person still standing there. I bought this nice necklace. And you see it has like a sparkle effect built into it. That was very nice. It costs about $1.50 U.S. Well, if the person who designed that sells 1,000 of those a month and they make 3 or 4 different kinds, that starts to add up, right? And so there are people who've made over $1 million U.S. by things they've designed inside of Second Life. And you also can make money buying and selling land inside of Second Life. The first person to make over $1 million U.S. Did it through selling real estate inside of Second Life. So the main thing about a virtual world is that it's a place of human culture that's realized by a computer program through the internet. It is not a game. As one famous writer about virtual worlds talks about, the Pasadena Rose Bowl is a stadium. It's not a football game. It's the venue in which the game happens. And Second Life, similarly, is not a game. It's a space. It's a virtual world. And there are a lot of different kinds of games that happen inside of Second Life. But it itself is not a game.
The key thing about it is that it's a place. And so you can do almost anything that you can in the actual world. And we've seen amazing things happening in places in Second Life. For instance, people who are disabled in the physical world that in Second Life can look like everyone else. People who are in chemotherapy and want to just be able to look like everyone else can do that in Second Life. Language learning, all kinds of education, all kinds of creative production has happened. There's all kinds of fascinating things that people are using virtual worlds for, and they are really new and exciting. Second Life didn't exist until 2003. But there is a history. And so one history that you could tell about virtual worlds would go all the way back to cave paintings. You know, Plato's cave are sort of myths that we tell to each other, stories that we tell to each other. And that's one way of thinking about virtual worlds. And actually, in my book, I talk about how the myth of Prometheus, because there's this very interesting distinction in Western thought between knowledge, episteme, and craft, techne. And the origin story for episteme in our tradition tends to be the story of Adam and Eve and the tree of knowledge, right? Which shapes us still to this day. If you see the logo on my computer right here, you see a legacy of that history of the tree of knowledge of good and evil that still shows up for Apple. The origin story for techne is Prometheus, who stole fire because humans weren't given wings or teeth or any of the other cool stuff that other animals got. What they were given in the original Greek myth is techne. Not just fire, but the ability to make things, craft, was their gift. And techne is, of course, the root of technology. And I'm very interested in how virtual worlds create these new possibilities for techne, for forms of craft that go way back but also offer these new kinds of possibilities. The invention of the novel, the invention of the telegraph, the invention of the radio, all of these things impacted virtual worlds, but the real place where they first appeared was in 1970. And that's just my irritating Gmail thing because my life is about multitasking in so many ways now. In 1970, Myron Kruger, I believe it was at University of Maryland, was doing an experiment where he had an office, and he had a colleague go to office in another building. And they were looking at two different waveforms, and they were trying to describe them to each other because they had cameras pointed at each other's monitors. This was very new technology in the 1970s, very, very fancy, right? And they were having trouble understanding each other, and Myron realized that they could turn the cameras 45 degrees so that the cameras were actually catching their hands. Instead of just looking at this monitor, it would actually catch their hands. And so then the two hands would be superimposed on one screen, like this. And Myron talks about the moment in 1970 when they did this for the first time, and he moved his hand up to show his colleague something, and his colleague jerked his hand back. And Myron had this kind of aha moment where he was like, he thinks we're in the same place. He thinks that we're in a shared place. And he realized that you could do this thing that you would call, he called it artificial reality, that eventually became virtual worlds. And in the mid-70s, the book he wrote about this was the image he drew for what he called a mega environment, that he said could have hundreds of people in it. And it doesn't quite look like Second Life, but it's the same basic idea. And so that really was the first inkling of what you could do with these technologies. But until the invention of broadband internet, because all that data that has to get streamed in, and computers with really good graphics cards and fast processors, you couldn't do much more than this. Early video games like Hunt the Wumpus, which actually you would like chase a bat around in these little caves, right, started to create some early ideas of virtual worlds. Adventure, if those of us who might remember the 70s might have played this text-based thing that actually was the inspiration for a lot of virtual worlds, where it would say, like, you were standing at the end of the road, and there's a forest in front of you, and then you would type in, like, go forward. That would say, you have entered the forest. There's a dwarf holding an axe. And you'd say, ask for the axe. And it would say, the dwarf killed you or gave you the axe or whatever. And it gave you that feeling of immersion. It's not the same thing as a virtual world, but it shaped it. Some early video games like Utopia, which I played as a kid, where you'd each have an island and you were building crops, building a house, very primitive 8-bit graphics, but once again has some of the early ideas that you'd see in a virtual world. The first real virtual world was Habitat from 1985, and Chip Morningstar and Randy Farmer, who created it, are incredible because they did this with people using dial-up modems, very basic, you know, technology, and Randy Farmer actually discovered the original promotional video for Habitat from 1985, when nothing else had been done like this before, and they had to try and explain Lucasfilm, had to try and explain to the public what the hell is this kind of thing. And I don't have time to play the whole thing, but I'll just play you a little bit from this rediscovered sort of ad. Remember that I had an avatar and that I teleported around in some way.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Parallel, well discovered, fully equipped. Oh, hey, mister, here's your paper. Intelligent beings, mighty the works. Read all about it. Hey, lady, here, have a paper.
Extra, yeah, let me see that. 5 cents, Pops. The name's not Pops. I just want to find out about this here parallel world.
It's called Habitat, but cough up that dough, Pops. No playing games.
Jimmy, the name's not Pops. Look, I promise I'll pay you as sure as my name is Valentino.
Valentino? What's going on here? What kind of game are you playing, Pops?
Pops and his friend Jimmy aren't the first people to get drawn into this strange new world where names can change as quickly as events. Surprises lurk at every turn. And the keynotes of existence are fantasy and fun, here in a place called Habitat.
What's a teleport booth? Where am I? And who in the heck are you?
It is said that boredom once ruled the lifestyles of the avatars, the beings who populate this world. But recently, all that changed. With the birth of an alliance between powerful beings, both here in Habitat and in the human realm, and with the cooperation of a huge mainframe computer in Virginia. Now, using their modems and Commodore computers, people from Westport to Walla Walla can join Quantum Link and Lucasfilm on an electronic journey unlike any other. One that leads to Habitat, where thousands of avatars, each controlled by a different human, can converge to shape an imaginary society.
Hey, listen, my real name's Henry. They call me Pops.
Habitat did not have voice. That was added for the promo. They just had text.
Controlling you. Here you get to be someone else.
Well, then I guess I really am Valentino.
And I don't have time to show you the whole thing, but you can see how, in fact, like later on in this little thing, they actually show him. Here's he, someone changing his look inside of his house.
Day.
This is one of Habitat's newest recruits, an avatar named Young Turk.
Just like mine. And so, and here you see the
I'm a lawyer with Klein, Cates, Kipling, and Klein. And right
trying
now.
To explain how it works. And this, these basic ideas are still there. So, for instance, if I come back to Second Life, so here I am, as you saw with my look in Second Life. Now, you know, at moment's notice, here I am back live inside of Second Life. Let's see, what do I want to look like? And so in a moment's notice, I can change my gender, my look, I can become an animal, I can become a dog, I can become a ball of light, I can become an elf. I'm on my way to becoming an elf right now. So it was that same idea that you saw with Habitat, just a little bit different. So here I am now turning into a giant elf. Or if I decided that I wanted to be an animal, I could let me see, where's my cute little, oh, here he is. Here. If I really want to change my look, take it a second to figure out what it is that I want it to do. It's, you know, he's saying, what are you trying to mean? So it's that same idea about being able, and this ability to change embodiment is one of the biggest difference, a really interesting thing about virtual worlds, because to change, we can change our clothes and things like that, but in the physical world, to change our gender or to become a small flying cat, as I'm becoming right now, would be very difficult, if not impossible. So here I am looking around. I still look gray because my textures haven't all come into being yet. But here I am. So now if I fly, you see me with my little flappy wings. Here I am. So smile for everyone. So here I am now with a very different look than I had just a moment ago. And now I'm a steampunk kitty cat, which is a very different look than I just had. So I can fly around and do all the things that I would do looking otherwise. So that, once again, is something that you see even going back to Habitat. And then other virtual, early virtual worlds that I'll just mention in passing. Ultima Online was one of the first big hit massively multiple online games, right, which are kinds of virtual worlds. EverQuest, many of you may have heard about. Actually, there was a recent study I don't have time to go into on the newest version of EverQuest, a player data dump where they actually, for the first time ever, a company that owns a virtual world, in this case Sony Online Entertainment, gave some back-end server data to researchers, which most of these companies don't do. But the interesting thing is that in terms of age breakdown, that you know you see people 30 and over is a pretty big percentage. And in fact, people 50 years and older is a significant percentage. And hours per week played by age group, that people in their 50s were playing just as much, if not more, than younger folks. And also, when they did the survey, they asked about body mass index, weight and height, and at least so far as they can tell, that players actually had slightly better health than the general population, going against this sort of couch potato idea of people who participate in these online spaces. Then I won't have time to go into all these, but The Sims Online came out in 2002. This is actually a crazy map of a whole bunch. Each of these dots is a virtual world. At the top, beginning with sort of ones that are for kids, I'll talk about those in a moment, going all the way around to ones for older folks. And this red dot right here is Second Life. So you can see Second Life is just one of hundreds of virtual worlds, and there's more appearing every day. It's really just snowballing right now. And like any anthropologist, I can't study everything, so the thing that I picked to study was Second Life, but there's many others. World of Warcraft is one of the largest, as some of you may know, and as some of your students may admit if you press them hard enough. and so where are these virtual worlds going to go is a really interesting question. What kinds of new possibilities do they hold? And people often ask me about that. And I see several new directions in which these virtual worlds are going. One is towards this kind of beautiful detail you saw in Second Life, but even greater detail and greater immersion. So a new virtual world that's just coming into being, just in testing right now, is called Blue Mars. And here's just a little clip of Blue Mars.
Blue Mars is a 3D immersive virtual world. And it's got it is currently in closed beta, but is opening up soon. I thought I'd offer you a quick look around to show you what it has to offer. As you can see, Blue Mars offers sublime graphics rendering. And there's a very good reason for that. It uses the CryEngine 2, which powered the graphics used in the revolutionary Crysis series of games. This allows Blue Mars to offer both excellent exteriors and interiors. The interface is simple, a little too sparse for my liking, but it's very early days.
One direction in which these virtual worlds are going. Another way in which they're going is towards gaming. I mean, the gaming, most of the biggest virtual worlds are still games. And I just saw several reactions of PhD students like, oh yeah, these aren't going away. The ones for games aren't going away. So, you know, Call of Duty 2 is an example of a recent one that its release was the biggest event in entertainment history, any movie, book, anything, ever, last month, where it made a third of $1 billion within 24 hours of it appearing. And these game-oriented virtual worlds, the buildings and stuff are pre-made, and unlike Second Life, where people are the participants are making them. But because they're pre-made, more of it can be downloaded on your computer, and there's less unexpected stuff out there for the computer to deal with, which allows them to get even a greater amount of detail and realism than the open-ended ones like Second Life, where people are creating all kinds of new stuff all the time. And so here, just to show you a couple moments of what Call of Duty looks like, and just the incredible level of visual detail that they can get. This is a virtual world. This is not real. I mean, this is not human actors.
Until the last man standing has fallen.
This appears to be the work of the ultra-nationalists led by the shadow of Zakhaev, one Vladimir Makarov. The Kremlin, however, sees it differently.
Support to aid in any way possible.
Zakhaev kept Makarov in check, but no longer.
The world's
when you
men of
the
action will look and wonder. How it came to this.
He's got a contact in Rio.
Don't you have a guy on the inside?
So that's another direction that they're going. But another direction is in the opposite direction, towards more simplicity. And there's two reasons for that. One is for what I call platform agnostic bubble worlds, which is a big mouthful. But what I mean is virtual worlds like Metaplace that run using Flash off of any browser. You don't have to download a program. They're much simpler, but anyone, you can download them much faster, and they're easier to use. So just to show you a few seconds of what Metaplace looks like. Which is one of the most successful
in virtual world creation and sharing to everyone. Let me show you some of the cool stuff you can do here and why it's different from any other virtual world out there. You can build anything you want in Metaplace. This may be your starter world, but you can turn it into a cafe for you and your friends, a zombie killing game, an Amazon storefront, or even a gallery showcasing you and your friends' artistic creations. What makes Metaplace different is that anyone can use it. Our tools make it drop-dead simple to build. If you want to get more creative, you can quickly import stuff from the internet or get access to what others have created through our marketplace. You can even
notice that they mentioned Amazon briefly. You know, the head of the company that runs Second Life often talks about how if you go to the website for Amazon.com, at any moment in time, there could be 30, 40, 50,000 people there at the same time that you are, but you have no way of knowing it. You have no way of interacting with those people. And so one thing that will happen probably, and I'll mention this in a bit, is that this kind of virtual world stuff will affect everyday web use more. Another direction that things are going is virtual worlds embedded inside of social networking sites or cell phones. So, for instance, this one down here, Yeovil is a recent one I'll mention in a second, but this one, Motropolis, is I have it on my iPhone. It's a virtual world that runs on an iPhone. And I won't play. I'm just going to show you a few seconds. But here you are. You can touch the screen and move the little guy around. You can see it's a virtual world. You can interact with other people. You can play little games. You can make your avatar dance. This is done, I actually have this on my iPhone, so you can move around and talk to other people. It does the same basic stuff as Second Life. You are walking around, you can talk to people, do all those kinds of things. A great example of this is Farmville, which is our farm town, which is now the most popular application on Facebook. It has over 30 million active players, way bigger than Second Life, which is a virtual world that looks very simple. You farm in it and hang out with your Facebook friends. But it's a virtual world inside of Facebook. Huge. I mean, it's been around for less than a year and has 30 million active users. So virtual worlds are both getting more complex, like the Call of Duty Blue Mars stuff, but also getting more simple, allowing them to appear in things like smartphones or inside of Facebook, inside of websites. From the beginning, many of the biggest virtual worlds have been for children. So like Club Penguin was sold for $700 million recently to Disney, which is a virtual world that looks like this. I won't show the whole thing. Any of you who know about things like Maple Story, have a hotel, there's a Barbie virtual world, a Hello Kitty virtual world, there's all of these things. Actually, there's a new one called Mush Monsters, and I can just show you a few seconds of what it looks like. These virtual worlds for children tend to be much more heavily policed.
Mushy Monsters, the world of adoptable pet monsters, where you can play games, get creative, and connect with friends. Visit the adoption center to choose your Mushy Monster. Color it just the way you want, then give it a name. Now you're ready to take your monster home.
Limited, you can't look like a giant penis or something like that.
Every monster has a personality that changes and develops the more you play.
But once again, kids
treat your monster well, and you'll have a loyal pet. Treat it badly, and you might set off a fiery temper. There are many ways to take care of your monster. Play with it. Feed it.
This is just coming online. I think it's still in closed beta. And then another one is that the web itself, more generally, is going to start looking like a virtual world. So, like, if you ever want to go to YOOWALK, UWALK, and play around with it sometime, which is where they actually interface with the I'm going into this live right now. Hopefully, it'll work. Just to show you live, where you're actually interacting with the web live with an avatar. So here's my avatar. There I am. And you can walk around. See how I'm walking around? And then each of these houses is a website. So you go inside of the website at the house, and then the website appears up on the wall. See that? But you could hang out with your friends and discuss what you're reading online and do sort of a social use of the web. And so there are a lot of experiments around integrating virtual worlds in the web this way, which I think are going to be really fascinating. So in general, once again, I want to encourage us to not move too quickly to judge these things negatively, because you know John Naughton, who's an observer of technology, his wonderful first law, we invariably overestimate the short-term impact of new technologies, but underestimate their longer-term effects. This was the web page that McDonald's paid millions of dollars for in 1996. Top-of-the-line technology at that point. It had a picture of the McD and the golden arches, and that was it. Very, very basic from today's standards. If you think about things like Google or Facebook or Twitter, if you know about Twitter, those things are mostly like 2 years old, 3 years old. We did not have them in 1996. But especially if you think of Twitter, or even eBay or Amazon, or a lot of these things, they technologically are not that difficult. We could have had Twitter in 1995 or 1996. We could have had Facebook back then. The reason that we didn't is not a failure of technology. It was a failure of imagination. We did not know yet what to do with the new technologies. And so at first, we made with the web, web pages, because we used the old metaphor of books to think about the web. And we just slapped text up on the web. And the idea of using it like Twitter or Facebook or these other uses took us a while to figure out, but not because of the technology itself, because we had not yet thought of what might be possible with it. And virtual worlds in 2009 are very similar to where the internet was back then. I think we're just beginning to tap some of the possibilities that virtual worlds could be used for and what some of their possibilities could be. And that's why in my own work, I had done this research in Indonesia, but to try and understand these cultures of virtual worlds, because many aspects of them are new. There are aspects of virtual worlds that are unprecedented. I could not do this at Dickinson College. I could not show up here as Dickinson College looking like the woman on the right and decide, you know, I think I'm going to change my ethnicity, right, or change into a cat. That is new. But not everything about virtual worlds is new. Many aspects of the social interaction come from our everyday physical world lives. Around the world, different countries, different cultures impacting these things. And that goes all the way back from something like habitat to contemporary things that look a lot snazzier, but many of the basic issues are the same. You know, dancing in a club inside of Second Life. These kinds of things could have happened. Even I love things like this. It even looks like an ocean with a buoy in it. This is a social space inside of a computer, and this idea of nature is very significant. All of these things that may not look that different at the beginning, actually, I think, are very consequential. And so I don't have time to show all these images in detail, but I mean, there's a lot of fascinating stuff people are doing inside of Second Life. But what things are new and what things aren't, like the picture that my original avatar looked in Second Life didn't look that different. I love this cartoon about, you know, here's Second Life, that you can do anything you want. It's this fantasy place. Which one are you? The kid with glasses with a laptop, right, who doesn't look that different, right? And I'm very interested in things that may not appear that different at the beginning, how they might show us about these broader patterns. So this was my avatar in Second Life with my laptop, and I tried to use the same methods that I use in Indonesia of participant observation, hanging out with people in all these spaces, focus groups. This is an earlier version of my house, me sitting there in the house talking to people and having a focus group discussion about identity inside of Second Life. And my research really worked. I was surprised by how well it worked, and I think that really showed me that many of the things that we think are new about virtual worlds actually are things that are drawing off of long-standing things that we've had in our culture for a long time. Now, there's a lot more I would like to talk about, but in closing, because I want to get to the point of getting some questions and answers, and there's so many things I could talk about, but to close, before I do questions and answers, I just want to show about a 6.5-minute video a beautiful machinima that gives us one idea of what we might be able to do with virtual worlds, or a hint about that idea where our imagination is still not caught up to what virtual worlds might be able to do in the future. So this is one vision of what a virtual world might be able to do in the future that I think is very fascinating. And it's just, not counting the credits, it's just about 6.5 minutes long. I'll show it, and then I have a lot more stuff, I could images or movies I could show you or I could talk about, but I'll save it. Thank you.
and take some questions. So thank you very much, and let's have some questions. Yes, go ahead. Okay, got a bunch. Go ahead.
Excuse me. Sure. Thanks. When I watch this and take a conventional perspective, I see these virtual worlds as fantasy, and this flesh and blood world around here as reality. And as an anthropologist, because I'm accustomed to being in unfamiliar places, unfamiliar worlds, I'm always asking myself, what does this particular expressive event or this particular expressive object that is expressive of culture mean to the flesh and blood people around? So I see these, and I'm thinking, when you convene focus groups in virtual worlds or when you chat in virtual worlds, what is it that you as the anthropologist are trying to find out?
Well, I'm trying to find out what is significant to folks in these online spaces about why they spend time in these worlds and what's significant to them. And that can include why they find it, how that impacts their physical world life. But actually, my writing, I never use virtual and real. I use virtual and actual because we don't want to imagine a real world that has no computers in it. And because one of the things I talk about is how we've always been virtual and how in many ways ethnography has been always about a kind of avatarization of the self, about being in the place of another culture. And the reason why you can have 30 million people get into one of these things in 6 months is because something from the physical world is being built on, or people wouldn't know what to do. And so there's such a whole range of reasons that people will find things meaningful in virtual worlds, and it can be everything from escapism to, you know, getting away from something, to many people feeling that they have more meaningful relationships sometimes in a virtual world, because they'll say in a virtual world you get to know people from the inside out, not the outside in. So I meet you in a virtual world, and I know many cases of people that become very intimate and only find out after a couple months that one is an 80-year-old plumber and the other's a 25-year-old college student. They never would have passed each other on the street and talked at all. Or I know a case of a family in Canada that I did, you know, doing my research of four sisters and a brother that meet online instead of sending email or phone calls. And they actually share a house and they can do stuff together. But what's really amazing to them, to the sisters, is that the brother is severely schizophrenic and still lives with the parents. He's never been able to hold down a job. He's in his mid-30s and he's almost institutionalized. And he can't really deal with people very much. But in Second Life, he actually feels able to be more open because people don't know who he is, because you don't have to read facial expressions so carefully. So he even like made an art gallery, but he would hide under the water when people would come to look at it, but he even just made it. And that one of the sisters in particular talked about how she could do things with him much more than she could in the physical world. And she felt she had a more real relationship with him inside of Second Life. And she'll never forget when they were building a house together, a room together, and he started decorating it to make it into a college dorm room. And he told her, well, I'm never going to be able to go to college in the physical world, but at least this way I get to get a little feeling of what that might have been like. You know, and it broke her heart, but she could share that with him. And so it's interesting, or I know cases of people who think they may want to, who they're transgender, and they may want to change gender, and they'll spend time in Second Life before they switch their gender and may feel that their Second Life person, who is actually their real gender, and is more real than their meat space body that is actually not matching up to who they really are. But then there's much more mundane. I mean, there's those kinds of amazing stories. But then there's just the everyday. It's just fun to be able to make anything you want and be like a cat for half an hour or build a giant castle and experience it with your friends. And so it's not all of those kinds of, you know, more extreme or unusual examples. Just the everyday interaction. You know, when I would interview people and ask them how do they find the time to spend time in Second Life, what most people say is that they just don't watch TV anymore. And that they just do it in Second Life instead, and it's much more creative. They're getting to design stuff with their friends and do stuff together instead of just sitting there and watching TV, and they find it really liberating. And so, like, you know, I talked about selling the clothes for avatars. I've run into many cases of people who, you know, she's a housewife in Minnesota, and she never got to go to art school or design school because she got married young and had two kids and whatever, but she started making clothes in Second Life and found out she had a knack for it, and people started buying them, and maybe she's making $200 a month or, you know, not that much, but it really means a lot to her that people like her fashions and that she is seen as a successful designer in Second Life, and she never got to do that in the physical world. So you get those kinds of stories as well. I mean, there's just a huge range in what people can get out of these spaces, as with the internet more generally. And so for some people it's escapism, but for some people it's finding their real self that's more authentic. It can be a whole mix. There was a question over here and the one back there.
As I was watching your demonstration of Second Life, it occurs to me that in order to succeed in the game, or even enjoy the game, like the avatar has to invest lots of time, energy, and resources into the game. While the Second Life, unlike the World of Warcraft, which is like game-oriented and requires avatars to compete with one another for higher levels, better weapons, and higher social rankings, Second Life seems to be a more socializing, more like a socializing platform for people to socialize with each other. So my question is, what actually motivates people to stay on this game and invest lots of their money, resources, time, and energy into the game while they can use it otherwise to improve their real life, to pursue their dreams, and to pursue their goals?
Right. Well, first of all, this isn't a game, right? It's a virtual world, so it's not a game. Yeah. But the other thing is, like with the example I just gave of the housewife from Minneapolis, it is pursuing her real life goals. She always wanted to design clothes, but she never got the chance to do it in the physical world. So, you know, the physical online and offline are discrete. Like people who are in Second Life, you know when you're online or offline. I'm not a believer in saying that these things all mix together and that it's all exactly the same, right? But they obviously bleed through in all kinds of ways. And for a lot of people, this is not getting away from something they would be doing with their real lives. This is their real life. That's why I don't refer to it as virtual versus real. Or if you work for IBM or Cisco and your online office space is inside a Second Life and you're meeting with colleagues who do product design, that's not running away from your real, your physical world life at all.
So do you think that for one to succeed in a virtual world, one has to sacrifice in his real world, or do you think one can succeed in both?
Oh, you can absolutely succeed in both. There's no one answer to these things. I'm just like taking you around to some other virtual world places in Second Life. This is an artist who goes by the name AM Radio inside of Second Life, who builds these beautiful sort of fantasy-looking builds. Here I am hopping around like a cat. That are sort of surreal landscapes, beautiful surreal landscapes. And this will rez as I'm talking, just to sort of show you some other sort of artistic. I'll stand here by the lake for a moment. There's some other people standing here talking. But so it doesn't have to, I mean, the thing with the virtual worlds, like with the internet more generally, is there's never one answer to almost anything. Like, is it good or bad? Or do you have to do X or Y? You can, these things are very open-ended. So, you know, there certainly are cases where people find virtual world stuff can be negative because they are spending so much time inside of Second Life that their physical world relationships are suffering. They're not spending enough time with their kids or with their partner. They're staying up too late and missing work or doing whatever. But that's not unique to virtual worlds. When I was giving a talk at Babson College in Ohio last year, I mentioned this to some of the students. You know, one of the anthro professors was talking about me how where she was doing a kind of local ethnography exercise for her undergrads. So she took them around town, and one of the things she showed them was in one of the churches, the bingo parlor, where the older ladies, for the most part, played bingo every Thursday night to show them that. And one of the undergrads really got into it and started going back and started playing bingo so much that his grades were suffering, and the parents actually called up the college to say, what have you done to my child? They're failing their classes because they're getting, you know, into bingo. And so, you know, you can get into almost anything. I don't think that's unique to virtual worlds. And almost never do these things just have a single answer. So they can definitely have negative effects. You can run over people with a car. You can, you know, use a car to get to work. I mean, these technologies are value neutral. They can do a lot of good, and then they can be used for hate speech, or they could be used for crass commerce or whatever. So they're really very open-ended. That really is what we do with them that makes the difference, which is why it's so important to understand them, because we want to be sure we do the right things with them. So there was a question somewhere, huh?
I have a question about, like, say, when you mentioned about the culture of this place, no, again, in your view. So, it, do you mean this is a culture by itself, or it's a reflection of the real world?
It is a culture by the self. The problem with that word, that phrase, is the verb reflect. That it's a culture that draws from the physical world in all kinds of ways, but it doesn't simply reflect them. And this is actually an interesting parallel with my original work in Indonesia, because I study gay Indonesians in Indonesia. And what I'm so interested in there is how these Muslims halfway around the world use the word gay, which obviously comes from the West, but it means very different things to them. It's brought in and transformed in the context of Indonesian society. So in the same way, you know, I'm standing here in Second Life and there's violins on the lake, and, you know, I look like a cat and here's a boat, and, you know, there's some trees, and there's all kinds of things. You know, just like gays in Indonesia, there's snow. You know, it's wintertime, so of course you had to add some snow here. And, you know, there's this very nice house that has some, you know, beautiful interior to it and all this. This is drawing from the physical world in all kinds of ways. You know, with this incredible attention to detail. This is a very talented Second Life artist
beautiful work that this person does. And it really is an art form to get that kind of light effect. It's really gorgeous. But that doesn't just reflect the physical world. There's more going on than simple reflection. And so Second Life does have a culture, and it also has a lot of subcultures within it. No culture is unanimous, so there's a lot of subcultures in Second Life. But it's not just subcultures only. There are overarching things as well. Culture has different spatial scales to it, and so that shows up in something like Second Life. As I was mentioning to some students, I guess it was yesterday or today, whenever it was, we were talking about it. But, right now, are we sitting in the Stern building? Are we sitting in Carlisle? Are we sitting in Pennsylvania? Are we sitting in America? Are we sitting in North America? Are we sitting on the Earth? All and none. And you could analyze this social interaction using any of those spatial scales. And in the same way, you can look at Second Life in terms of this particular place in Second Life or the sort of larger cultural logics in Second Life, and then also what it shares and doesn't share with broader things, with other virtual worlds and other kinds of internet phenomena.
That arises to another question. So can you tell me more about your definition of culture? What do you mean by culture?
Because we're talking about popular culture, but I use a very straightforward anthropological definition of culture in the book and throughout, where culture is a system of meanings and practices and power relationships that are shared and that are not sort of biologically determined. Just like people share a language, right? Language is interesting. I was originally trained as a linguist, and so that's how I think about cultures in terms of those shared meanings and practices and power relations. And that's exactly what I see in Indonesia that I'm looking at and that I look here as well. So it's not the narrow definition of cultures, like high cultures, like the symphony and that kind of being cultured. The way an anthropologist thinks about culture is as this sort of shared way, a sort of worldview that we grow up with. And just like you, most people speak more than one language, most people are multicultural in the sense that we often have more than one cultural competency and grow up in more than one culture. There's a lot of multiplicity to culture, too.
When you say cultures, do we mean that the culture is the environment that you live in? It's because of the environment that you're in that you have the same certain kind of culture. It just depends on the environment that you develop certain type of culture. That's my question.
If you mean social environment and social norms, absolutely. And there have been schools of thought in anthropology and beyond that really try and tie culture to environment in the sense of, like, in tropical area, you're going to have one kind of culture, and in the Arctic, you're going to have a different kind of culture. That kind of narrow environmental determinism isn't so popular in anthropology nowadays and isn't so popular with me, but environment in the broad sense definitely shapes culture because, especially in America, we love to be individuals and we're all independent and how you dare say that I'm influenced by anyone else. But of course, we're very powerfully influenced by our cultural environments, but not in a robotic sense, right? It shapes us, but it doesn't determine us. I mean, the example, once again, because I was trained as a linguist, is you can't just make up a language sitting right here. And you can't decide right now you're going to make up a new tense in English or that you want to have a different way to say plural. You're sick of saying S, so from now on you're going to use, Y as a way of saying plural and say, I see lots of tree-y and there's chair-y in the room. You're going to have a problem, right? Because language is shared. You can't just make up a new language. But sitting right here, I can, at a moment's notice, make up a well-formed English phrase that's never been spoken before in the 500-year history of modern English with, billions of speakers. I can say, Tom is standing on the podium next to a laptop with many people in Dickinson. That phrase has probably never been spoken before in human history. So there's incredible creativity possible within structure, so to speak, right? Within a shared system of meaning. It doesn't determine us in a rigid sense, but it does have an influence, absolutely, and that's something that that any anthropologist is interested in.
Yeah. Sense.
There's a question about one here and then one back.
I was curious about your anthropological methods that you used to gather their stories through this virtual world. Because you say that about the housewife and other people's stories. How do you go as an anthropologist, or do you go as an avatar? Like,
right,
how do you
right.
separate yourself and still try to?
No, that's a great question. I'd mentioned to some folks earlier, I'm working on a book with some colleagues right now on a handbook of ethnographic methods for virtual worlds, because so many people ask precisely that question. So the basic premise that I used for this research was that I would be an avatar and do this research inside of Second Life, but I would not try and track people down in the physical world and interview them. And the reason for that is to be honest to the way the virtual world works, because like right now there's three other people I can see right now standing in this space. There's a good chance that they don't know each other, that they've never met in the physical world. This person could be a man in Japan. This person could be, you know, a woman in Italy. This could be someone from Australia. I wouldn't have the money for the plane tickets to try and meet all these people. And it would do a kind of violence to the virtual world to assume that I would only have meaningful data if I did that, because they're having meaningful social interaction here inside of Second Life. And so I want to take this on its own terms as a culture and study it and look at it. Now, just as I do with Indonesia, of course, outside things are constantly influencing things that would go on inside the virtual world. And when I would interview people or talk to them, some people only talked about their virtual world lives, what they did online. But some people would talk a little or a lot about things about their physical world lives. But I would never try and confirm those, because there's no way I could. And because, as I mentioned earlier today, talking to some other students, even to lie convincingly, you have to be doing it within the cultural logic so it makes sense. So, for instance, in Indonesia, most gay Indonesians are married to women, and I met a lot of their wives. They don't use a metaphor of the closet, and they think it's weird that I don't, I'm a gay man, that you don't think you can be gay and straight at the same time, Tom? Because, you know, here, gay, you just add it on, and you keep straight, so you do both. That's what you do in America, right? You don't? Oh, wow, that's weird. And that's how people would react to me in Indonesia. And most gay men there are married to women, and I would sometimes meet their wives. And when I would interview gay men, they would often tell me about their wives. Now, I didn't try and track down every single wife. There could have been times when they were lying to me that they were married. Maybe they wouldn't. But for the lie to even be convincing, it would have to make sense within this broader system of shared meanings. So I was interested in those stories, and in some cases I could verify they're true, and in most cases I couldn't. And the same thing in Second Life. People would share with me all kinds of physical world information. And sometimes I could verify it, sometimes I couldn't. And often what I was interested in is when hanging out with groups of people, when would they bring in physical world information? Like, was there a certain sort of thing that would cause people to start talking about that? So, for instance, I became very interested in time. There's a way that time resists virtualization in a way that space does not. So that all of these people, this person could be in Japan right now and we're online, but there's no technology that would allow me to be here at 8 p.m. and him in Tokyo at 8 p.m. and us to be online at the same time. It's not possible. You can't compress time like that. So one way that the actual world stuff would often start to show up is if you were playing a game or at a club or something and someone would say, folks, I've got to go, it's 2 a.m. And then other people would be like, what? Where the hell are you? It's 8 a.m. here, you know? And then they would start to tell a little bit about where they were in the physical world. So time would sometimes end up being one way, or emotion would sometimes be another way. So anyway, those are the kinds of things that I would use. But what really surprised me, I did this whole project as an experiment to see, could I use the methods I use in the physical world as an anthropologist? Would they work online or not? What would I have to change? And what really shocked me was how little I had to change. I was expecting to have to change a whole lot more, but very little actually had to change. And that, I think, says something very interesting about the cultures of virtual worlds. Okay, I'm sorry. Can someone... I can't see because of the light, so can someone else manage the questions? Because I can't... The light shining in my eyes. I can't quite see as our hands up.
Is it me? Oh, okay. So I was wondering, you talked about... you said that there are some subcultures, I guess, Second Life that are like actual life, and so I was wondering if there are any kind of breakdowns of like raced subcultures or subcultures of sexuality that get together in some sort of location in Second Life, because before you're talking about how people kind of may go on Second Life to maybe transcend their identity or get away from the confines of their body, but are there also people who are meeting to possibly meet other people of the same race or ethnicity or whatever. And right. Do they get together and have these conversations or
It's really hard to tell because because the company that owns Second Life, like most of the others, is very tight-lipped about giving out their server data. Like Sony Online Entertainment with EverQuest is the only one that's ever done that. And these folks don't even have that data for the most part, because you can get an avatar here without a credit card for free. You don't have to give any information. So often all they can tell is what country you're logging on from. And so we can look around at the groups that are in Second Life and see that, you know, there's interestingly an increasing number of like Africans that are in Second Life. Brazil has a big population, Korea, Japan. And often one of the biggest ways you can tell is actually by language, because of the languages that people are using, right? So you're seeing a lot of people speaking Brazilian Portuguese, for instance, and whole areas of Second Life that are Portuguese speaking, or whole areas of Second Life where everything is in Chinese or everything's in Japanese. So that gives us some clue, you know, that we can tell, but we don't have raw numbers on it. But then the finding people thing gets very interesting, because I've seen interesting debates in Second Life. One where I was talking to someone about a debate they had about a lesbian group that was meeting in Second Life, a lesbian support group, and someone said, well, what? We don't know if these people are women. And people basically deciding that it's actually against the terms of service, but also unethical in a way to sort of try and ask people to swear, like, what can we do? You know, that they're lesbian here inside of Second Life, and we can't really do a skirt check or, you know, have them send in a photo. I mean, there's no way to really verify that. Now, there are virtual worlds that try, or other technologies that try and make things line up more. And Facebook is the great example of that, where in Facebook it tries to really have you not have an alternate identity. And a few months ago, Facebook actually banned people from having Second Life avatars, like Johan Hancroft, have a Facebook page. A lot of Second Life people used to have avatar Facebook pages. And a few still do, but Facebook is weeding them out. They banned it, and it angered a lot of people. But they really want this thing to be very lined up. A lot of other virtual worlds don't care so much. And there's actually some other social network sites, I can't remember the name of the one, that basically sort of sent out a message to the Second Life people, come over here, you know, you can do your Facebook page on our site. We don't care, you know, you can be whatever you want. So it's interesting how that's happening. And these issues of verification, you know, Facebook is the great example of something that tries to get around that. But for a lot of these people, simply don't know, you know, except maybe by language. Or if you get to know someone well enough, trust. And how trust builds up in these virtual worlds is a really interesting issue. How you deal with trust is a fascinating issue.
We have time for one more question.
Do you think this would perpetuate more over here?
I'm sorry, what was it? Sorry, okay.
Do you think this will perpetuate more stigmas or stereotypes about different cultures, or will it break down or reduce inequality and racism?
I think it can go either way. Like, once again, I think these things are very neutral in the sense of what people do with them. So there have been cases of really homophobic or racist or sexist groups in Second Life that do very inflammatory things. It's not a big part of Second Life, but, you know, that kind of thing has happened. But then there's incredible kinds of educational or outreach things in Second Life of countries that have embassies, or there's actually a virtual Africa that the World Wildlife Fund runs or someone, and there's all kinds of things to help you learn about other cultures. There's actually someone from New Zealand made this amazing virtual New Zealand, or, you know, doing those kinds of things. And then also there have been really interesting cases of people talking about how I went into Second Life and on purpose for a couple days or for a week, I became a woman or I became a black person and I learned something by the way people treated me. And you would think that in a virtual world it wouldn't make any difference. And sometimes it doesn't, but sometimes it does. And you get treated differently if you're a man or a woman, or you get treated differently if you appear to be a different race, or if you don't look human, if you're like an animal or whatever. And I've had people talk about how that was a real eye-opener for them in a way that they couldn't do in the physical world, to really feel what it's like to be in someone else's shoes, to have a different identity. So, you know, once again, these technologies can be used for all kinds of good or not so good purposes. And there's, you know, another way in which there's great potential is now that there's big parts of Second Life that are, and other virtual worlds that are Korean speaking, Portuguese speaking, Japanese speaking, run by people in different countries. You can go to these places and speak to a native Chinese speaker and practice your Chinese and look at the replica of the Forbidden City that they've built or done whatever in much more cheaply than flying to China. And it's almost like a kind of pin pal thing that some people have set up. And I interviewed a lot lot of people who one of their favorite things about Second Life was meeting people from other countries and other cultures and learning about their cultures in a way that either because they didn't have enough money or time, they couldn't travel the world so easily. They could meet people from all around the world and actually do stuff with them and like go to a dance club and talk to them about their lives or whatever. And so for some people, that's something they really find fascinating. Other people don't. So I think there is a lot of potential for greater cultural understanding, and people have talked about making an island for like Israelis and Palestinians where they can't kill each other, do this kind of thing, or one for the two halves of Cyprus or North and South Korea, or you know, whatever. The people, there's all been all kinds of interesting ideas and experiments about those kinds of things, and I don't think they're going to be an inevitable success or an inevitable failure. It really depends on what people do with these technologies, but there's certainly some interesting potential things out there for increasing understanding. And will that continue or accelerate, or will it actually go away or go down? I don't know. But there is good potential. Thank you. I'll stay up here for a few minutes if anyone has any other questions. Thanks a lot.
Please join me in thanking Tom Velstorf. And this will conclude our program. Thank you for attending.